This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for December 2013. I'm Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Lindsay Garbutt, assistant editor for the magazine. On the podcast this month, we'll hear work from Amelia Phillips.
What is past remedy calls for the surgeon's knife.
Tomas Q. Marin.
Because there's only so much room in a two-bedroom walk-up for 48 birds.
And Eileen Miles.
I'm aiming for that empty feeling. I'm going to get some of that, and then I'll be back.
In the December issue, we also have poetry from Louise Glick, Douglas Kearney, Ray Armantrout, and many others.
And for prose, we have an essay by Marianne Baruch about melodrama, a notebook by Merrill Gilfillan about what he calls al fresco writing, and a review by Alfred Korn of Mae Swenson's collected poems.
And I'm really glad about that because Mae Swenson is a terrific poet, and I haven't seen too many reviews of this book, but it's her collected poems. Very exciting. Well, this is the first time we've had work from Amelia Phillips in the magazine. Two poems, and we're going to hear her read both of them now.
Amelia Phillips is the author of a book of poems called Signaletics, and she's the emerging writer lecturer at Gettysburg College.
Last spring, Amelia had minor surgery to have a melanoma on her cheek removed. The experience in the waiting room before her procedure led directly to the poem, Reading Ovid at the Plastic Surgeon's.
There was lots of pleasant sort of smooth jazz going on and people playing with their cell phones, and there was the profile of the marathon bombers on CNN, and I was reading Ovid and the metamorphosis and seeing all these patients about to have cosmetic surgery or were receiving Botox, and the whole situation seemed absolutely absurd to me.
The poem has an epigraph from Elizabeth Bishop.
I scarcely dared to look to see what it was I was.
Here's Reading Ovid at the Plastic Surgeon's.
No one else with a book. The slick weeklies gossip amongst themselves on the side tables as the ticker rolls the Dow Jones down, 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 under a profile of the marathon bombers, the older a boxer. Jove argues for the removal of a race of peoples that do not please him. What is past remedy calls for the surgeon's knife. They will take a hunk of my cheek, cancer, and though I can't see during the procedure, I imagine the sight as an apricot bitten. This is a survival mechanism, romanticism. David says, if you're out in public and you don't want anyone to talk to you, bring a book of poetry. Even as I enter the confidence of the room, I avoid my reflection in the window, for there, most of all, I see myself as only I can, as only the eye will have me, as light alone.
That's quite an extraordinary thing that she's able to do here, you know, combining the classics of poetry all the way down to and including Elizabeth Bishop in her waiting room with the news as it's unfolding that day and her own personal trauma without inappropriate self-dramatization, but sort of tying in all these things together that result in a complex reflection on how our reading becomes part of us, part of our bodies, as well as our minds and our imagination, and change our imagination in such a way that, in her case, seeing her appearance physically altered by this procedure has a context for it. It sort of alters the way she can think about it or even see herself or understand herself.
Yeah, and she addresses that in the poem when she says,
and though I can't see during the procedure, I imagine the sight as an apricot bitten. This is a survival mechanism, romanticism.
This reading that she's done and her ability to write about it is what allows her to get through these experiences. And mm-hmm. It allows her to use this kind of romantic, typically poetic language in a poem that, you know, is also so focused on reality and the news and her immediate environment.
It has witty turns to it, too. I mean, that weird rhyme of mechanism and romanticism is very telling. And there is that romanticism of, you know, walking around with a book of poems.
Right, but even that's a survival mechanism, so no one will talk to her.
Yeah, yeah. And that, too, is interesting to me because, Lindsay, you know, we've been looking for ideas for a feature somehow, but there are photographs of women reading that we were all looking at mm-hmm. in the office. And there is something fascinating about this idea that reading makes you a private person when you're in public. I mean, that's sort of emblematic.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see it in photos or even paintings. And I just read about a performance artist who rides the subway and pretends to fall asleep on people's shoulders as a way of sort of dramatizing, I guess, what we already know about being out in public, as this poem says. Mm-hmm. You're out in public, but you don't want anyone to talk to you. And in this case, you know, you have a screen, which is a book of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of takes you inside yourself so that you don't have to be out anymore.
And it ends with that kind of personal note, I see myself as only I can. That echoes the epigraph from Bishop to see what it was I was.
Let's hear the second poem in the issue by Amelia Phillips. This one is called Saul Bass Redesigns the First Man.
Saul Bass was a graphic designer. He's most famous for logos. He's done the AT&T logo, the Bell Systems logo, the Girl Scouts.
Saul Bass was also famous for his movie title sequences and for his animation.
One of the techniques that Saul Bass did was he would use strips of paper to create certain scenes. So he would take strips of paper and then combine them in different ways.
As you'll hear, Amelia brings something of that paper strip animation technique into Saul Bass Redesigns the First Man.
The epigraph is from Saul Bass. I want to make beautiful things, even if nobody cares. To make, you first have to create materials. R.E. Man, we know the rib removed, but before? Forget ash to ash, dust, etc. Stick a floating rib, i.e. thoracic 11 through 12, you know, Edenic, in a glass of water with the promise it'll grow roots like leek or fur like chia. The joke's Crusoe astride the bone, or Jim and Huck paddling rustic as a ballpoint pen will go. No, that's not a plank in your peeper. It's a hollow, Q running faucet, a Pabst crack opening into seraphic choir, risk handles, a perfect major, root third and fifth. With aesthetics like a bad comb over, you don't need a mirror to know what you are missing. Now that you have this thing, you've got to feed, roof, and rockabye baby. You're the big boss. Head honcho, but watch out, foreman. Little Evie and Adam were the first organized union. 1, 2, 3, 4, don't give us pain and labor. So what'll you give him in return? Latin and genus, genius, medicinal plants. I call this Vladimir Nabokov man. Or do we let him take for himself by fount, fin, and medium, language. Though from this, we know creation is only myth, destruction, narrative.
It's not often that I get to read poems that reflect on how things sort of come back together. So you'll get poems that reflect on creation or creation myths or, you know, you get the narratives over and over again and you become familiar with them. In this case, what you're really seeing is these disparate bits and pieces, the strips of things that can be brought to bear on reflections about larger design, which I think is very appealing. It's a kind of poem that I don't mind bumping along with. It feels very alive and invigorating.
And I think it's great to talk about them as sequences because that really draws in the Saul Bass connection. I mean, he created this little documentary called Why Man Creates that kind of goes through the creation story, like how man has created, you know, everything from Michelangelo's ceiling paintings to modern day creation. But it has a lot of jokes thrown in there, too.
Right.
And all of Saul Bass's animation, you know, you think of Man with the Golden Arm or any of those animation sequences for his movie titles, they're all kind of jagged and not exactly perfect, but that's what makes them beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of why this poem appeals to me as well.
Though from this, we know creation is only myth, destruction, narrative.
So, Don, what do you make of we know creation is only myth, destruction, narrative? I mean, she's kind of pairing those two as two sides of the mm-hmm. same coin.
Well, I think it's a way of admitting that there's no way to pin things down neatly mm-hmm. and that it's unstable and that there's destruction, both literally in the myths and stories, which are about kinds of destruction, but also that the language itself is sort of particulate. So that's what we know from not only language, but our ideas about creation itself, is that there's all this particulate matter and it has to sort of cohere intermittently for there to be meaning,
mm-hmm.
that there's flux, which is both creation and destruction. I think that's what's happening.
Stick a floating rib, i.e. thoracic 11 through 12, you know, Edenic, in a glass of water with the promise it'll grow roots like leek or fur like chia.
Yeah, and it does kind of loop back on itself because, I mean, taking that rib is a sort of destruction that becomes its own creation.
Right. This is sort of again, to me, it strikes me as a somewhat unusual take on it. You know, it's not the sort of traditional thing, you know, and they lived happily ever after and were fruitful and multiplied. It's more complex and somewhat darker. Some of the reflections in her poems are spirited but rueful in just the right measure, not sort of self-pitying
mm-hmm.
or anything like that, but sort of looking at the more uncertain elements that we try not to think about all the time.
That it's the destruction that makes the narrative.
Yeah. This is also the first appearance in the magazine of Tomás Q. Morin, and we have four of his poems in this issue.
Tomás is the author of A Larger Country, which won the APR Honickman First Book Prize. He's also a co-editor of the anthology Coming Close, 40 Essays on Philip Levine.
And his poems actually have a kind of kinship with Levine's. They both construct plain-spoken narratives around precisely observed details of everyday life.
Let's listen to his poem, Nature Boy. The poem mentions Wahoo McDaniel, the Native American football player who went on to a storied career in the wrestling ring.
And he ultimately became a kind of folk hero for his athletic prowess.
Nature Boy. If I had enough cages to keep all the birds I've collected over the years, then I would have to open a shop, because there's only so much room in a two-bedroom walk-up for 48 birds, not to mention the dancing bears and the frogs, or the different varieties of fish, the one species of flea. And I almost forgot the proud dogs and the lone mule, the profane one who entered my life to curse its scribes and Pharisees. And maybe he'd let the mouse I found, forever dying at the end of a poem, right on his back, like a whiskered Christ. And if not, maybe my Yeti could do it when he's not downtown working security at the store or teaching the parrots how to say brotherhood in grunt and how to comb out the tangles and mud from his hair, whose sweat reminds me of that bearded collector of beasts with the ark, who would have no doubt understood how I feel. That prophet of change, under whose spell I want to confess that I'm a Christian of the Old Testament, that my grandfather hung all his goats upside down, their throats over a bucket, and slapped their chests like that other nature boy who strutted around the ring like a peacock, with his feathered hair that stayed immaculate even on the nights he lost to our hero, Wahoo McDaniel, who never played the heel, he who hailed from the lost tribes of Oklahoma, who made us want to be chiefs so much we wore pigeon feathers and circled each other inside a green square of water hose, until someone finally rang the bell that was never there, and we sprung toward each other like animals in love or at war.
One of the great things about listening to Tomás, and I had this experience when I went to a reading of his over the summer, was that you don't know where he's going from one line to the next. Everything is an astonishment. That's one of the great delights of poetry, is being astonished and then experiencing surprise upon surprise. And there's something about the way the intense in serious way that he reads his work that really underscores that for me. So I can't quite explain why I find this so fascinating and delightful, but his poems really all do this, and it's extraordinary to me. They are so wide-ranging. and funny in sort of unaccountable ways.
If I had enough cages to keep all the birds I've collected over the years, then I would have to open a shop, because there's only so much room in a two-bedroom walk-up for 48 birds.
Just when you're thinking about those birds, he ups the ante.
Not to mention the dancing bears and the frogs, or the different varieties of fish. The one species of flea.
I mean, he's got an enormous range of vision. And yet it really does feel like a Philip Levine poem that this stuff is coming out of his daily life, his real experience. And each of his poems seems to invoke and almost create a whole neighborhood for me of characters, of thoughts, of fascinating presences that sort of awaken odd memories that I have myself.
The transitions are amazing in this poem, and they're kind of hard to point to at the same time because they're so gradual. I mean, as you said, the beginning is strange but like plausible, and then he gets to the Yeti and the mouse is a whiskered Christ.
And maybe he'd let the mouse I found forever dying at the end of a poem right on his back like a whiskered Christ. And if not, maybe my Yeti could do it when he's not downtown working security at the store or teaching the parrots how to say brotherhood. And grunt.
Those parts make you laugh out loud, but then it ends on such a personal note of this model that he grew up with of the nature boy.
Yeah.
And this beautiful image of young men, I assume.
And we sprung toward each other like animals in love or at war.
Wrestling in this water hose ring.
Yes, the menagerie includes not just animals, but people in danger of being somehow overlooked.
Let's listen to another poem by Tomas Q. Morin. It's called Love Train, and I'm not sure it needs much more of an introduction than that.
Love Train, for Deandra. My bowl brimming with pretzels, the snack you wanted least, I slid open the door of our sleeping car where we had been enjoying the country rushing by, as if we were the first two people to look down into the valleys and see bright necks of pines stretch across farms and streams to the groves they once cradled. You had asked for Earl Grey cookies sandwiched around buttercream or marshmallows made of chocolate, but all the tea bags had been dunked and the chocolate melted over biscotti. When I came bearing the salted and twisted news, the room was empty but for a heel. It was black as a bunting and wound with zippers, and every time the car rocked, it looked ready to fly and escape into the cold, tangled air of travel that always feels heavy with joy and desire and a little sadness. Always a little sadness because of the leaving, which is what I do when I realize I'm in the wrong room and that numbers have betrayed me again while I was hunting and gathering, foraging like Homo habilis who probably never lost his cave. Out of patience, I opened every door marked with threes and eights, those conjoined twins disastrously separated at birth, and roused the scabbed eyes of sleepers like a beggar. No, an angel, a begging angel who's written on his heart, will work for love. Having not found our room, not heard the sharp swing of your voice, I descended upon the passenger cars and row upon row of couples, asleep or staring out the windows like zombies, trying to remember what happens next. Once the newspaper is well thumbed, the tea has gone cold, and the conversation is dead. I called for you, in vain, even using your secret names, the ones only the night knows. Wind kiss, brilliant fruit, dervish moon. Over and over I said your names, over and over until they filled the wounded air of the car. And when there was no more room for another sound, they caught and hooked the ring of the brakes hugging the rails. Just when I thought I wouldn't find you, you were there. The train was pulling away, and I was watching you slowly eat a dish of whipped cream and bananas, the house special, in a cafe in a city we didn't know. When you finished, we started walking down a road that bent like a smile, a shy smile, like the one the Japanese cat wore on your purse. The road, we were told, would take us to the end of the line, where all lovers in search of joy, packed on bullet trains, they're the fastest on two continents, arrive every hour.
It's quite a train, right?
I know, yeah. This poem has a lot in common with the previous one in that It's filled with these long, very vivid sentences that create quite an image of an everyday setting, but with these kind of fantastical elements mm-hmm. to them.
The room was empty, but for a heel. It was black as a bunting and wound with zippers. And every time the car rocked, it looked ready to fly and escape into the cold, tangled air of travel.
And then this transitions into this sadness, and then the sadness because of the leaving, because which is what I do. And that has like a funny moment to mm-hmm. it, because all of a sudden you've transitioned out of this image that you have in your head and you've gone to Homo habilis.
Well, that searching and the movement of that searching, again, is part of his wide-ranging capability. Mm-hmm. He's looking for this person and invoking so many parts of what we see in somebody, kind of like what they eat, or maybe a shoe, or a favorite dish of some kind, or a secret name. Mm-hmm. But the way all these things are sort of arrayed and deployed, there's like movement and focus all at once. Even at the end, there's movement when the poem is sort of finishing up.
The road, we were told, would take us to the end of the line, where all lovers in search of joy, packed on bullet trains, they're the fastest on two continents, arrive every hour.
I can see, like, you know, the trains coming in and coming in and coming in, and it's as if they'll never stop. Mm-hmm. You know, these love trains just go on and on and on, and that there are people on there. You sort of can take your place in the poem as one of these elements.
It has a very mythic quality to it, I think, too. I mean, starting with that first stanza where he says, as if we were the first two people to look down into the valleys, it has a very Edenic quality to it. And then at the end, the road we were told would take us to the end of the line. It yeah. kind of covers the whole trajectory of life.
Eileen Miles was born in Boston, but since the 1970s, she's been in New York, where for many years she was associated with the St. Mark's Poetry Project.
Her many books include a recent novel, Inferno, which fictionalizes the life of a lesbian poet very similar to Eileen Miles. She's also written libretti, plays, and many books of poetry.
A few months ago, we reprinted a very short poem by Eileen Miles in a children's poetry portfolio curated by Lemony Snicket. So for all practical purposes, I guess you could say this is her first appearance in the magazine as well.
We have three of her poems in the December issue. One is called Dream, another is called Dream 2.
I went through a period where I kept waking up with enormous dreams that I absolutely remembered. And so I just, you know, made them instantly become poems as I woke.
Hot off the press of the unconscious, as it were. Let's listen to Dream 2.
The car had a cover over it, and it was over the wheels, and it hurt my ass, and I couldn't sleep. It seems I should move, go forward now. I was wandering through the jungle, anywhere on earth, but I was a woman, in bed in New York, and how many people have died in wild places, dreaming you were still in bed, would you know? Travel well, I said to my dog when she went on her journey, thinking of a cheap movie. I thought this was an urn. Turning, this was on water, this was flat. But now I see light between the trees, I see water trickling through stone. This is not made of language, but energy that will stop when I die. The dream dies too, one bolt.
One of the many amazing gifts of this poet is to make a dream seem sharp and plausible and alive and awake. Mm-hmm. I think dreams really are physical. We feel them and experience them, you know, so they're not sort of just in the imagination.
The car had a cover over it, and it was over the wheels, and it hurt my ass, and I couldn't sleep.
I mean, that's exactly how a dream feels in your body when you're experiencing it. It's not like some hazy vision. Mm-hmm. You know, the details are very clear as you experience them, even if you don't know exactly how to narrate them. But that's marvelous that these dream poems really narrate themselves in such a concise and therefore completely striking way.
Yeah, they have great movement to them. From the car in the beginning to,
it seems I should move, go forward now.
And then she's wandering, and it pushes the poem along at such a great pace. And the ending with,
this is not made of language, but energy that will stop when I die.
Even when you're in your dreams, you're so full of energy and movement, it doesn't end.
Mm-hmm.
You're not stationary.
Well, she's really put her finger on something there. I mean, when I first read those lines, which are very lovely as well, as seems to be true. Now I see light between the trees. I see water trickling through stone. This is not made of language, but energy that will stop when I die. It's very poignant and very true. I mean, what happens to these things, you know? They sort of go away with us. That is a dream that ends, you know. But what is remarkable is the poem doesn't stop there. That reflection, which is so arresting, is not the end of the poem or the end of a sentence.
This is not made of language, but energy that will stop when I die. The dream dies too, one bolt.
And that one bolt is the last line of the poem. You know, two strong syllables, one bolt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just when you probably think you've read a zillion poems about dreams. I mean, Eileen Miles' dreams are like new dreams for us.
Let's listen to another poem by Eileen Miles. Not a dream poem, but dreamlike in the fluidity of its language and images. It's called Prophesy.
Prophesy. I'm playing with the devil's cock. It's like a crayon. It's like a fat, burnt crayon. I'm writing a poem with it. I'm writing that down. All that rattling heat in this room, I'm using that. I'm using that tingling rattle, that light in the middle of the room. It's my host. I've always been afraid of you, scared you're God and something else. I'm afraid when you're yellow, tawny. White, it's okay, transparent, cool. You don't look like home. My belly is homeless, flopping over the waist of my jeans like an omelet. There better be something about feeling fat. What there really is a lack of emptiness. I'm aiming for that empty feeling. I'm going to get some of that, and then I'll be back.
What a great ending.
Yeah. It's almost a stupid cliche to connect her with New York school poets. But what she is the great continuation of in her work is the sense that every line is alive in the moment of its being written, that there's somebody there, somebody present in each line at that moment. Yet there are these fantastic moments, things like your belly flopping over the waist of your jeans like an omelet.
Mm-hmm.
That astute combination of just mundane detail, this is happening, plus the wild stuff that surrounds us and makes us feel like we're beings that have imaginations and moral responsibilities, mm-hmm. is the achievement of this kind of poem, and this poem in particular.
Yeah, I think that ending with, you know, you don't look like home, and then my belly is homeless.
There better be something about feeling fat. What there really is a lack of emptiness. I'm aiming for that empty feeling. I'm going to get some of that, and then I'll be back.
And that's what she's looking for. Thinking of home as a sort of empty feeling is a very interesting goal, and that you could just grab some of that and then come back.
That to me feels very New York, you know.
Right.
It's like, I'll go to grab some of that and I'll be back, you know.
Yeah.
And I think she will be. But also the aspect of sexuality in the poem is to me terrific, and again, such a larger part of the concern of much of her work and what she is when she's speaking as herself, say, mm-hmm. participating in the moral and social and political world that we're a part of, which she addresses very directly all the time and makes her so important to us. But, you know, I'm playing with the devil's cock. It's like a crayon. It's like a fat, burnt crayon. I'm writing a poem. I'm writing that down. It's like taking stuff back. It's an edgy way of saying, I'm taking something here. I'm taking hold of something. I'm taking back something. I'm wrestling with something. I'm arguing with something. And she's sort of able to construct and posit her own very vigorous presence against something that is threatening and overpowering. You sense in her poems this pushing back against this crushing kind of social system. She's just there pushing right back in every line and in every poem. But the poems do that because they're poems, you know. They're flat-out statements of the imagination, but the imagination that's rooted in kind of moral reality. You can read Eileen Miles' poems and everything else you heard on this podcast in the December issue of Poetry Magazine.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Lindsay Garbett.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.